Because I remember reading George Orwell 1984 when it was still in the future. This just has a little bit of a hold on. And I remember thinking, this is just never going to happen because the human race will just not really tolerate an oppressive regime like that. But on the other hand, we are now giving all of that information voluntarily because you know, we can be tracked every minute of every day. People know exactly where we are. People know what we eat. People know where we work. And we put all of that information out there voluntarily. So in a way, George Orwell was completely correct.
When Disciplines Meet is a series of podcasts from the Scottish Graduate School of Social Science, the UK's largest doctoral training partnership for social scientists. With these podcasts, we aim to discuss the aims, nature, and practical experiences of interdisciplinary approaches to research. This episode is on the topic of AI and disciplines for the future. My name's Laura Young, and I'm an interdisciplinary researcher and host of this podcast series. On this episode, I am joined by three guests. Professor Monica Harvey from the University of Glasgow, welcome.
Thank you very much, Laura, for inviting me. Delighted to be here.
Thank you. Sabiha Mohammed from the Alan Turing Institute. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And Dr. Vasilis Galanos from the University of Stirling. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I would love to kick off with hopefully a simple question, but who knows? What discipline are you from? And of course, how are you approaching AI, the topic that we are discussing today?
Okay, I'll go first. So I'm an information scientist by training, but I have a PhD in science and technology studies. So I have some technical background on, you know, how computers work and how we create databases and so on. But I was soon captured by the love of the sociology about this. So a typical question we had back in information science was whether information studies as a discipline is part of the humanities or part of computer sciences and so on. And later on with my studies in science and technology studies, I encountered the same kind of issues, like should an STS scholar be part of a technical background, have a technical background, and then move on to the sociological study of it? Or should sociologists expand their knowledge as to understand the technical questions? At some point, AI came in, its recent hype. So that's what I'm currently studying, the hype around artificial intelligence. And by the same token, the hype around interdisciplinarity. So I'm very much interested in how interdisciplinarity is sometimes tokenized in order to speak about AI and how AI might be tokenized in order to meet interdisciplinary needs.
And Monica, what about yourself? What discipline do you come from and how did you get involved in working with AI?
Yeah, so my discipline is actually, so I'm a professor of psychology and neuroscience. And for the last sort of 20 years or so, I've basically been interested in people who've suffered from strokes. And as a result of the stroke, have some cognitive impairments. And I have a particular interest in studying sort of attention and perception impairments. And I really spent, you know, the last of those 20 years probably trying to come up with rehabilitation strategies and improving, you know, the sort of cognitive outcome for these patients. I was really very focused on my discipline. But then AI sort of became a big buzzword. And I'm also the co-director of a center for doctoral training, which actually looks at socially intelligent agents. And I realized that AI can actually be really useful in healthcare, because this is obviously where I come from, it's what I know. And the most fascinating thing which I'm currently working on is actually trying to make predictions of cognitive impairment from brain images. So I'm working at the moment with a young lecturer in our department, Michaela Swanira, who has come up with a foundation model, and we're currently working on that. And the idea is that you look at a single MRI image and you can make a prediction about the impairment that that person is going to have in the future. And I know that this is super ambitious, but we have already worked on something called the brain age gap. So you can actually compute, you know, the from lots of images, a healthy brain. So say somebody who is like my age, sort of 60, the healthy brain, we know what that looks like. And then some people then have a gap between what their brain looks like at the age of 80 and the age that they really are. And we already know that there are strong correlations between the bigger that gap is, the more impaired people tend to be. So if they're smokers, the gap is bigger. You know, if they basically don't do much exercise, the gap is bigger. So at the moment, you can say that's not very exciting. That's just correlation. But we really want to then move on from that to prediction.
Oh, fascinating. And Sabia, what about yourself? What discipline are you from and how do you approach research and AI?
Well, my primary background is actually from the humanities. I did my undergrad and my first postgrad degree in South Africa that was in the humanities. And alongside studying that, I opened my first business and that was a tuition center where I taught mathematics. And so I was running the business and teaching maths while studying my degree in humanities. And that sort of all came together in my interests in the intersection between technology, people, society, and also seeing how these things play out in the education sector. And so I then went into the field of digital humanities, which sits within the Department of Information Science, which I did my master's up here in UCL. And I think all of that sort of was the natural bridge into the field which I'm working in now, which is AI ethics and policy. And I'm working as a researcher at the Alan Turing Institute. And so all my projects that I work on in one way or the other look at the ethical and societal implications of AI and whether that's in, you know, different groups, for example, children, or even in terms of how the systems are being built, but very much focused on that social and ethical lens.
Fantastic. Just to see the range of disciplines that you come to, but all working with AI. And Vasilis, I know that you have done work on the history of AI. People who don't work in this field at all or don't research this would probably think AI would be AI generated images and videos, or they might be familiar with ChatGPT, or, you know, now when you Google something, you get a little AI summary. But what actually is the history of AI? Is it something that has only been around for a few years, or does it go back any further than that?
Yes. So thank you for the excellent question, Laura. So AI has a long history. At the same time, it's fairly recent. So it can create lots of controversy as to whether it is a discipline or not, right? So as a term, it exists since 1955. And there is a funny story behind it. So people who were experts in the field, they used to call it automata studies. And they invited researchers to send their papers for a special issue. They never got the papers they really expected. They wanted to understand how the brain works, how intelligence works, and whether you can replicate it. So in order to get some funding for a summer school, they came up with this term, artificial intelligence, just to get the funding. Right. This is publicly sort of documented. So it's a very interesting story. There has been backlash about the term. So members of that infamous summer school from 1956, once the funding got allocated, said that you shouldn't call it that. You should call it complex information processing, because that's a more sort of honest way of naming. So relating to information science and so on. Of course, this idea of robots dates back to the antiquity. So, you know, sometimes we prefer to mix our religiosity or our literary aspirations with scientific endeavor. And for many, many centuries, even today, we must claim the two are very hard to distinguish. So in ancient mythology, in ancient religion, we have this sort of aspiration to create something. We have 17th century automata and so on. Now, as of the 50s, AI starts to become established as a discipline. There are more and more papers being written, different approaches. The contemporary approach, the generative AI or large language model, is the combination, I must say, of the two main strands or sub-disciplines, if you may, of AI. One is called symbolic AI, where people think that intelligence works by deductive reasoning, as we say. So you follow instructions step by step with very little data. The other one is called connectionism, and it's more of an inductive approach. I'm using these terms because social science scientists might have be familiar with them. So you get many examples. You get your empirical data, right? And you derive your theory from the many examples. So this is called machine learning or deep machine learning. A combination of the two now is called generative artificial intelligence, where you get, you give some instructions, the prompts, you get them against like a vast database and some modeling. So again, some instructions there. And then you get a new output, but I place emphasis on quotation marks around the new because there are statistical rearrangements of existing things. Now, the novelty is debatable. It's rather past-oriented in my view. So there's lots of history, and I'll return to some interesting aspects of it in a minute.
And Monica, I guess the work that you do is looking at AI in a really promising way for health. How do you bring together different disciplines as part of the work that you do? And any reflections on how that has been kind of pulling together these different strands?
Yeah, and in fact, Vasily, thank you so much for the fantastic introduction about what AI actually is. So I think my first attempt was what I mentioned before. So I'm kind of running this Center for Doctoral Training on Socially Intelligent Agents. And it's effectively sort of training 50 PhD students over a period of 7 or 8 years. So they kind of start with an intake of 10 students sort of per year. And that's really the goal, to basically train them on basically building socially intelligent agents, but also interrogating socially intelligent agents and looking at the pitfalls and the advantages. And then the question is really how you do that, because the approach there was very much interdisciplinary. The person I'm working with, the director, comes from computing science. I come from psychology. And of course, people talk about interdisciplinarity a lot, but they find it really hard to do. And I think what people find especially hard to do is to become experts in two disciplines. And people have tried that, and I think it's a hard thing to do. So what we did with the Center for Doctoral Training, we were basically saying, okay, we don't expect people to change dramatically, but we want them to learn new things. So we have two different types of intakes. So we have one intake of students who are kind of trained as computer scientists or engineers, and they then work on that aspect, but they also then have required training in psychology. So they need to do something, they need to learn something about the brain, they need to learn something about social psychology. So when they are then building these socially intelligent agents, you know, they then need to incorporate psychology into that. So these are the more technically trained people who really learn about psychology. We then have psychologists who have particular questions, you know, saying, okay, this is probably a bit like Sabia, what you're interested in, you know, what are the ethical implications if we have like an intelligence system which kind of sits in healthcare? How do all the people interact with that? Do people become too attached? You know, is that a problem? Or if we basically have models, you know, what actually goes into the models? Is there like a bias in terms of the population that the data is based on? So these are questions which are quite familiar to psychologists. So they mainly focus on that. But we also want them to learn a little bit about the models, you know, what Vasily was saying. So they need to learn a little bit about, you know, model building and, you know, how you kind of interrogate a model, how you validate a model. So that was kind of the idea of kind of bringing the disciplines together without making it too impossible especially for PhD students to learn about everything.
And I'm interested in the students that come to this program. Is it about research or personality and you just get some people who are more open to being a bit more interdisciplinary? Or do you get people that come and are a bit hesitant about potentially stepping outside of their expertise or their background?
That's a really good question. So we spend a lot of time interviewing for these PhD students, and a lot of our questions are kind of really around, you know, where the students coming from. So we're kind of looking for students who haven't just come the straight, you know, sort of school, undergrad, and then kind of applying for a PhD, maybe having done a master's. We're kind of looking for students who had a bit of a background, who maybe worked as teachers, who kind of spent some time in industry. So when we're interviewing them, we really want them to have a bit more of an already like a wider outlook, not to be kind of too focused on a particular project. So that was one of the things. But then I think what was interesting, actually, so when we interviewed the students, I think they kind of caught on to that. So we had quite a lot of students who kind of went, yeah, I'm kind of interested in everything. And then I think you then end up with a cohort, which is a little bit bipolar. So we did then have the students who then focused a lot on the technical aspects and really found it quite difficult to kind of really learn, you know, from the other disciplines. But we then also had some other students who kind of really embraced the interdisciplinarity. So, for example, I had a student who was kind of working with autonomous vehicles, and she came from a very strong kind of engineering background. And, you know, I just basically said, but autonomous vehicles, you know, don't you want to look at who uses the vehicles? Maybe there's this difference between young people and older people. And she really embraced it. So some of the students have really taken on the challenge and really embraced it. Other students found it quite difficult. So, and I think this is probably the reality of, you know, what you end up with. Despite us trying to interviewing and being a bit arrogant, I think in our selection saying, oh, we probably selected students based on the fact that they have this broad outlook. I think in reality, you know, we probably didn't manage that, you know, so well.
And Spia, the work that you do is looking at AI, and actually, as Monica alluded to there, this ethical implications of these different programs. I'd love to hear some of your reflections on the work that you do, specifically with AI and that sphere, but also this idea of when you bring people together in this interdisciplinary way, how that works in practice.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So in terms of how we work as a team, I think I'll start there and then go into a bit of some of the work that we do on the ground. So I work in a very interdisciplinary team, and I'm based within the ethics and responsible innovation team. But really that's made up of people who are philosophers by training, myself in the humanities and digital humanities, data scientists, and people from social science. And so we have a very diverse team that we all work together. And I think that's really the starting point, because you're working with these people on a day-to-day basis. And eventually it sort of all blurs together and you don't really think that you're all working from different fields. And I think that really happens when you all working towards a shared objective. And whether that's in my team or without team, I've sort of found that happening more and more. And then in terms of the actual work that we do and how that, you know, that has an interdisciplinary lens, I'd say that in some of the projects we worked on, so for example, going into schools, and we were really interested in how the use of generative AI may have impacts on children's well-being, for example. And so we had to take a very interdisciplinary approach to this work. We had to work closely with people, experts in the education sector. We also had to work closely with experts from the children's rights perspective and experts who were really skilled in engaging with children, because I think that in itself is a skill. And then we were coming with a technical and research expertise in that. And so we all worked together. It was a collaboration of researchers from the Alan Turing Institute and then individuals from the Children's Parliament, as well as the different schools who worked with us and the teachers who worked with us. And we went into the schools and we spent time with the children, all day workshops. We had about six in-person workshops where we worked with children between the ages of 8 to 12. And we brought in different generative AI tools, and they got to interact with it. And then, and we, as the researchers, we were observing their choices. We got to talk to them and ask them, you know, what were their feelings about using the technology. And then sort of alongside that engagement component of the work, we also ran a survey. So another team working with us, they ran a survey to include teachers and parents' perspectives on this topic as well, and to see sort of taking that collective view and the collective approach really to conducting the research. So yeah, I think that's one of the examples. And I'll just touch on another one quickly, and that was work that we looked at in terms of public engagement and AI. So if you're really interested in including public voice, you know, in an AI project, whether you're coming from a developer perspective or from a policymaker perspective, and you're aiming for those higher levels of engagement with the public. So going beyond surveys, going beyond just consultations, but looking more towards co-creation and co-design. So how do you do that? And we worked pretty closely with RAI recently and on their Public Voices and AI project. And we spoke to experts in the area, people who facilitate public engagement work quite often. And we were interested there to see what are some of the best practices and the methods that they use to engage the public on the topic of AI, and see if there's, you know, there's gaps or challenges or more resources that are needed to support that approach.
And when you're doing these projects, because it sounds amazing to know that there's all of these different stakeholders and disciplines, and even the sort of lived experience of parents and children or whoever it might be. What is it like to actually bring all those together? Are there challenges when it comes to creating a project? And are all of these different stakeholders open to the idea of working together, especially in this sort of AI is quite a fast-paced, innovative, exciting project? You know, how does it feel to bring all these voices together? Is there that openness across the board?
Yeah, I think most of the, well, all the projects that I've worked on, and there's been a real complete variety of the projects, but maybe I was a bit lucky in that all the people I worked with were very interested in the topic, and definitely they were open to it. I think it's more in terms of the challenges that arise in terms of sometimes logistics or the time that it takes working with multiple collaborators and people from different disciplines, and sort of just building that into the project. And you know, sometimes you can have different understandings of the same word, and I think that's really important to establish from the beginning of before you, when you're working together. So I think it sort of moves towards those, you know, those ways of working and effective ways of collaborating and relationship building and project management. But yeah, the starting point is that everyone is interested and everyone is working towards that shared objective that I was saying. And then I think sort of things move quite smoothly from that point onwards if you have effective leadership and you've got, you know, really good relationship building and so on, then it's worked out quite well.
Language is something that has definitely come up in a few of these episodes. And Vasilis, we caught up before recording this podcast, and I know you do a lot of work around language and metaphors. And there was one that really stuck for me. Maybe it's just because I'm so interested in sustainability, but this idea of the cloud. And I feel like that's something that's stuck in my mind about language and how it's used by different disciplines or perceived by different disciplines. I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about that example as something that feels quite relevant to this conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you very much. And thank you both for your insights. So the more I have studied the history and sociology of AI, I think that there are many things to say about language used. A funny anecdote, I guess, from a 1980 paper I was reading about influencing policy and reaching that sort of shared consensus as to our goals and so on, is that interdisciplinarity in that book from 1980 is used as a challenge, as a word. It seems it's not a virtue, it's more like a vice. So the author says that, and we will reach that point on the table where interdisciplinarity will come in and we will never find consensus. So it used to be considered a problem. So this is quite interesting. So with the cloud in particular, which is one of the buzzwords that have been used across the, probably during the last, 10, 15 years, this idea that, you know, the digital sphere is an immaterial, ethereal substance, as very well documented by various researchers, has implications in obscuring the material processes that go behind AI. These could be the material cables, the processes to construct the technology. We have to remember a smartphone, for example, that applies AI is full of precious metals that are extracted from land under horrible situations. They are recycled as well, usually with, I can recommend you look at my colleague Joyce Serwa Opong's work, who has done lots of research in waste management sites in Ghana, where underage workers are sort of melting the cables of old computers to extract the copper without any protections and so on. Gore images that I would advise that we look at, because this is the materiality and the reality behind our wasted, I don't know, iPhone 25 or whatever the number is right now. The labor as well. So it's also the labor that goes behind the content moderators. Investigative journalist Billy Perigo covered a couple of years back how Kenyan workers are hired by OpenAI to content moderate ChatGPT to sort of reflect less of the undesired biases in our society when we prompt it with 4chan type of prompts. And also lots.
Can I just cut into that? I mean, it's an interesting story. So on our Center for Doctoral Training, we have David Hogan from NVIDIA. And he was basically saying when it came to the large language models, he said NVIDIA could have done that, no problem. Mm-hmm. But they didn't want to do that. And this is such an interesting point. I mean, effectively to hire this cheap labor to kind of deal with all the toxic content and to kind of, you know, that's, yeah. So this is such a good point, which nobody ever, I mean, I had no idea that that was even necessary and that had to be done. And it's something that nobody ever talks about.
And this is also something that relates to the history of buzzwords. So there have been many articles of this kind, like similar to to Billy Perigo's that have covered how Facebook did that 10 years ago, 15 years ago. But because the buzzword of the day is different, we reinvent all these entire social or ethical issues. So there are books about the materiality of computers, for example, from the 90s. I know one from the 90s. I know one from 2005. But we don't cite them anymore because they don't use the terminology that was hyped at the moment. With AI in particular, there is an interesting phenomenon. You can call it a folk theory. I prefer to call it like a folk theory. It's called the AI effect. As soon as AI achieves something, that something is not considered to be AI anymore. So, like I said, AI is very old, sufficiently old, like 6 decades old. So many of its achievements do not count as AI anymore. So Google search or search engines, this is an AI outcome. But we don't count it as AI. We count as AI the little summary until it becomes banal, until it becomes part of the everyday life. We are disillusioned from it. There is a so-called mini or more massive AI winter. And then we lose faith in AI. But the actual scientific or technological output is still there. And what happens often when there are these moments of disillusionment, the experts in that particular field, for example, search or neural networks, they will build their own conferences, their own journals, scientific journals, their own cliques and circles, academic circles, and they will identify with a different name and they will try to create hype around their domain, right? So, for example, Jeffrey Hinton, whom I've interviewed for a History of AI project, admitted that for many years he didn't call it AI because the rest of the AI mainstream scientists didn't consider his approach the main AI approach. Now that his approach has been successful, he readopted the term for public sort of benefit or understanding of it. So it's very interesting how language works. And because I believe in literature as a mode of understanding these things, I recommend everyone reading the works by Samuel Beckett, who talks about the absurdity of language very often, where our logical sort of reasoning might enter a halt. And that's my little 2 cents about the role of language and AI. Yeah.
Yeah. And if I can just build on that. So when we were working with children and right at the beginning, we were interested in, what do they think about AI and how do they interact with it on a day-to-day basis? And really that started with, them identifying where is AI in their day-to-day life. And they went on a mission with their classrooms and they were trying to identify. So from the time they wake up to the morning and the time to go to the sleep, where does AI actually touch their lives? And that got them talking about things like, is there AI when you go to McDonald's and you're ordering food and you're touching the screen? Or when you come to the traffic light, right, and there's cameras and it, is there somewhere AI there? And there was that whole conversation is that, we can't see it. You know, some people had one understanding and others had others understanding. And they were talking to adults, they were talking to their families about it. And everyone had different opinions actually on, really, where is AI embedded into our day-to-day lives? So, you know, whether you're talking to very academic circles or you're talking, you know, at home, which people of all ages, I think that understanding of what AI is and that awareness and identification of it sometimes do very different things.
And do you think, because this is such a fast-moving industry, new AI things are popping up all the time, or maybe it's just we're noticing that it's AI and it's been there all along, do you think the ethical question is keeping up with the fast pace of the technological innovation?
Unfortunately not.
I think we've said the same.
Yeah, unfortunately not. But I think this is sometimes, it's in my opinion, it does heavily touch on values. And that's why it draws out sometimes more ethical questions, more ethical concerns, I'd say, because the values are misaligned from the beginning.
And Monica, in the work that you do, I mean, when people talk broadly about AI in healthcare, it's normally in an incredibly positive way because we're talking about efficiency, maybe cost savings, you know, innovation. Is that a reflection that you have from the research that you've been doing?
I think it's really interesting. I think the medical establishment is quite conservative, so they know that they have to embrace it. But then they also then want to say, well, you know, unless there have been sort of controlled clinical trials, you know, we're not kind of doing it. So I think people talk about embracing it a lot, but I think in reality, there's actually very little in healthcare. And, you know, the example that I was giving earlier, so say we will actually manage to come up, you know, with a foundation model where you can literally look at an MRI image and make some predictions about, you know, a sort of an Alzheimer's patient or, you know, just generally more cognitive impairment. I just don't know how, whether that will then be adopted by clinicians. And I think, and to some extent, I can see their concern, because I think in clinical trials, people are really concerned about openness, transparency, repeatability. And I think this is coming back to your point as well. And I think in AI, that doesn't really happen enough. Mm-hmm. So I think whatever models we adopt and think are out there, they really have to pass these ultimately scientific criteria. You know, any of us who do science, you know, we want the science to be open, we want it to be transparent, we want it to be repeatable, we want it to be continuously evaluated. And I think the medical establishment are quite conservative. So I think by the time they will, and because AI is such a fast-moving field, I think once you probably implement something, it'll already be out of date. So I do see real promises in healthcare, but also real challenges for it to be adapted, like, say, in a GP surgery or, you know, sort of in a hospital. Because I think that's the tension between being rigorous but also being so fast-paced, and then, you know, that sort of catching up with each other.
If I can share something based on my very little engagement with AI in healthcare for a short presentation I gave a few years ago about gender, healthcare, and AI. So for those who are listening or watching this episode, you might or might not be familiar with the concept of false positives and false negatives, which is a huge thing in medicine. So if a prediction, an AI prediction, is, say, 95% certain, what does this 95% mean? For most people, it means like, yeah, that must be right. But a 5% possibility of error can be fatal. So a false positive can mean lots of very expensive medicine, for example, for breast cancer, right? Or for virus kind of, even mental health kind of diseases, right? And usually this might mean public taxpayer money, right? Or personal money, personal savings. So that's for a false positive. For a false negative, that can be fatal. That you're not ill might mean that you might die, right? So there. Now, the difference with old AI systems, so for many years, from the mid-80s up until the 90s, AI was masked as knowledge-based expert systems. It was during that era of the AI winter when people lost faith in the term AI, but those who did computational healthcare called that knowledge-based expert systems. And there were papers about the same things in the mid-90s, criticizing the exact same things. And now we call it AI. But now the main difference is that now generative AI might come up with a very convincing linguistic output that interprets the result. So you said very wisely, somebody has to look at the prediction. But if you get the interpretation ready, and it's written in a convincing language, in this sort of generative AI type of convincing language, then there is danger. This 5% might disappear because of the rhetorical expression of generative AI models.
I think this is such a good point. This is such a strong point. And I think generally, because I think also when just getting back to sort of more poetic point, like predictions, like, you know, identifying, I don't know, breast cancer or identifying a tumor. And, you know, and AI models can do that with even 95% accuracy. That's still catastrophic, you know, in a medical environment. I think, yeah, so I totally agree with those points. And you can see why we need to be careful.
And there are cases. I mean, in the UK, we had the final exams case, the algorithms deciding whether, high school students from different neighborhoods and social class backgrounds would have the right to go into the university and so on. There are loans being decided on the basis of this, but the computer says no, to allude to Little Britain.
Well, I think one of the reasons why maybe in the health space also there can be so much of hesitance is really it brings up the question of liability. You know, at this point, if there is a matter that something goes wrong, the doctor, the healthcare professional is usually, you know, held to account. But when you adopt these systems, I think that question about, well, who is going to be held accountable? And that can definitely cause a lot of hesitance here.
I think this has been, yeah, such an interesting reflection on, if I'm honest, a topic I don't know much about. You know, I'm the sort of end user or beneficiary of a lot of AI, but it's fascinating to hear from your perspectives the different intricacies. I'm wondering as well, does age play a part in any of this? Because, you know, as you said, history has played a big role in AI in the development. Are there different perspectives on AI depending on generational gaps or ages?
Well, thank you for staring at me for this question, because I have a very specific answer. It was one of the most surprising, interesting moments during my PhD, when, you know, you have your interview data and you want to find things in order to classify them and present the results. And age was a factor. I didn't really check for age initially, but then it became a very obvious pattern. So people, old timers in the AIs, let's place the boundary on the 60 years and above. So those who had direct experience with the first AI generation, from a disciplinary perspective, they were, I would say, most of them intrinsically interdisciplinary. They wouldn't use the term, but they would have broader education. They would be very much aware of what is going on in psychology, in education, in the physical sciences, in literature. They would all comment on the different science fiction films and books, even the very recent ones, despite their age. And there's nothing ageist about this, but it might relate to things about attention spans and contemporary uses of technology, AI being one of them, right? And whereas the younger people brought about in a society of huge ambiguity, huge volatility, gig work, and so on, their treatment of AI and the discipline was more like a technique, was more like a profit-driven tool. For the older generation, AI was more of a domain of curiosity. So that helped me create a little map of AI researchers, a spectrum, if you may, that one end who could be called the curiosity-driven or exploratory research often goes with very little funding because you're passionate about something, but you don't have the language to convince somebody about, you know, the importance of this thing. And then on the other end, the more profit-driven or exploitative, sort of explorative people. So there is this trend. Today we call it AI. I'm going to jump on the AI bandwagon. Yesterday we called it smart technologies or cloud technologies or whatever the term of the day is. And we jump in it, we associate our names with it, and we produce something. And interdisciplinarity plays a role there in as a buzzword as well, like how show demonstrating how interdisciplinary my team is as opposed to another. So then for these younger people, interdisciplinarity becomes a token of discourse, a currency, if you may, again, subjective to hype and so on. So that's my understanding of the intergenerational. Again, I don't want to sound ageist or anything and sort of glorify the previous generation. Actually, they have done lots and lots of mistakes. We know that, for example, they didn't see through their curiosity, they didn't see how military organizations would take advantage of the research currently used in lots of military warfare operations across the world, and they weren't able to protect their findings from these uses. But they were more, even if they were politically sort of alert about things, they didn't see that their own field could be subjected to the same things that they were fighting for. So,
yeah. Well, to your question, and that's really, really interesting. And it's just reminded me that we actually found something really interesting in our research with children on AI. And we contrasted that with some survey data on how adults think about AI and AI-related issues. And we found that when adults were made aware of the environmental impacts of AI systems, they ranked it a bit lower, and they ranked more economic concerns like cost of living as a higher priority in their opinion. But when we worked with children and children were made aware of the environmental impacts, that ranked number one. Like, children were really, really interested, and they felt very strongly actually about the environmental impacts of AI systems, to the point where actually in one of our workshops, one of the students said that they would not want to participate in using the generative AI tools anymore because they felt so strongly about the environmental impacts. And we also hosted the world's first children's AI summit earlier this year. And one of the themes on that was the environment as well. And we had children coming from all across the UK for this event from over 33 schools. And once again, you know, this was a very strong theme, how children felt about the environment. But we sort of see that decline once you sort of get towards your teenage and adult years and how important the environment is, actually.
That's so fascinating. I think it speaks to the importance, though, of having that interdisciplinary approach, because actually, as a user, you get to then have all of the information at your fingertips to make a decision on whether you want to use it. But I think that's so interesting to hear your reflections on age. But Monica, I would love to ask you about, you know, what's driving the research in the AI, because I know that yourself and Sabiha, you both are quite issue driven or driven by the social needs of these things. Is that what's driving AI research, or is it economics? Is it politics? You know, what's driving this field forward?
Yeah, and to be honest, I think Vasily can probably answer that much better than me, because I am distinctly a user of AI. And,
yeah.
And I think we should really use AI to just answer important societal questions, you know, to answer questions on the climate, to kind of solve problems with healthcare. So to me, I think, and it's so interesting, Vasily, what you said about basically people using different terminology, you know, throughout sort of time. Because ultimately, you know, I think it's kind of deep learning, you know, these are just models which we can use to kind of help ourselves answer questions better. So my research questions haven't really changed. You know, I really want to look at cognitive impairment. I want to effectively improve the lives of people with cognitive impairment, and I now use AI to do that. So I think I see myself as a user of AI, and to really ask interesting questions and get AI to help with the answers. You know, that would be, so then saying, you know, where is AI going? To me, it's a tool. You know, but that might be really wrong. You know, but I think it's a tool, and I didn't really think that there was much value in it, and maybe this is true for a lot of people, because when we were talking earlier about large language models, because to somebody like you as an expert, it's nothing special. I totally agree, and it's just a development. But I remember ChatGPT coming out in November 22. And there was a colleague, and he was effectively saying, and we have this sort of, you know, center for cognitive neuroimaging, and we were kind of talking about, okay, how do we define the center? How do we kind of, you know, sell it to the public? And he's like, have you seen this? If you type in Center for Cognitive Imaging, University of Glasgow, and ask ChatGPT to give a definition, it came up with a perfect answer. And we were just like, wow, you know. And at the time, we kind of thought, you know, this will change our lives, this will change everything. And of course, it hasn't, you know, because ultimately, we still have the same jobs. We're kind of still here, and the world has either not been amazing or, you know, been destructed. But to me, it's a tool. But I think it's a really exciting tool. But you know, that's, I am a user. You know, that's kind of all I can say.
Yeah. And Sabiha, how do you see AI? Do you see it as a tool, or is it actually morphing into a discipline of its own? And how important is it for it to be either a tool or a discipline, or can it be fluid in that?
I think AI is something similar to the way I think of language. So you have discipline on its own for language. You've got people specializing in it, linguists and communication experts. And whether that's, you know, in the academia, or whether that's even in the workspace and industry, you'll have those people who specialize in it. But we all need to use language, and we all need to be skilled in communication to a certain degree, regardless of our professional background. And I think AI is something like that, in my opinion. Yes, you have those who specialize in more technical, and you need that technical expertise, definitely. I mean, whether or not it's going to be a discipline of its own in the future or not, I don't know. I think there's a lot of factors around that. But it does definitely thread through all other disciplines.
And Vasilis, thinking to the future, you know, AI may become a discipline of its own. It may morph into that. It might just stay as a tool. But I feel I can put this controversial quote to you and see your reaction, because, I mean, as a non-AI expert, one of the quotes that I've certainly heard before is from Stephen Hawking saying it could be the end of the human race. You know, is he an expert in AI who can give that away? Or what is your reflection on that? Because that, you know, is a scary thought coming from someone who is deemed an expert in this world of innovation.
Thank you for this question. I mean, uncannily, I I published a paper on that 2 days after the passing of the late Stephen Hawking. So it kind of marked my career. My interpretation of Stephen Hawking's statement was that he used his expertise in one field to become a public commentator on other fields, which is a very important question about interdisciplinarity in general. I call that phenomenon expanding expertise. There might be a correlation between the properties of the expanding universe in Stephen Hawking's cosmology there, something that might have stuck in his unconscious. But what I found was that these kind of statements, so Stephen Hawking doesn't have a background in computer science or coding. I'm sure that, he was definitely a smart chap. So he probably knew some stuff about coding, but he actually created lots of frustration around AI circles. I'm not an apologist for the AI circles, but I observed this. And it also generated a very false start for contemporary AI policy. So from my research, what I saw was that right after Stephen Hawking's statement, Elon Musk made a very similar statement, Bill Gates made a very similar statement, and these statements were eventually used in the 2016 policy documents from the EU, US, and the UK that were the first three documents that then dominoed in the now sort of exponential number of AI policy and regulatory documents. It still has its repercussions to the AI Act. The AI Act is based on risks, which is a very interesting way to start a policy document. Policy is meant to give some guidelines and out-tos instead of what to avoid. So this risk type of language, the existential risk, is very interesting. I don't think, I'm not one of the people who believe that humans will be replaced by AI, just because I don't think so highly of humans in this case, and I don't think that they will ever let something like a superior kind of consciousness to take over them. They will fight for their rights and their dominance. We are a very dominant species, unfortunately, and I just don't think that we will ever have the electricity to get sufficient AI. But what we might get is a different type of existential threat, if you may, or all the minor things. So we can think of things like George Orwell, 1984. We can think of some of the classics and the little dangers. So labor intensity, for example, AI vendors promise shorter work time, right? They say you can use ChatGPT, whatever, and save some time on this. But they don't speak to the line managers who regulate how much time you work per week. So that means you can produce more using this, but within the same working hours. Are you paid to work for 40 hours a week? You still work for 40 hours a week, but now you can produce papers, peer reviews, PhD chapters, anything, you know, reviews, reports, blog posts, LinkedIn posts, all this within a single working day. And then the intensity of labor is what, and you're exhausted in one day. Do we want this? I don't know. So maybe for the future, I think that AI offers us a very good springboard to ask what are disciplines for and what do we want from our disciplines and our working environments. Maybe because of what it does, it might give us a good opportunity to think outside of AI, to think beyond AI and critique the technology without being affiliated with neo-ludism, for example. Resist it without just a sort of resistance without a cause. Resist it with a cause.
Can I just pick up on one of the things that you said? This is sort of slightly related. Because I remember reading George Orwell 1984 when it was still in the future. This just tells you a little bit of a whole And I remember thinking, this is just never going to happen because the human race will just not really tolerate an oppressive regime like that. But on the other hand, we are not giving all of that information voluntarily because you know, we can be tracked every minute of every day. People know exactly where we are. People know what we eat. People know where we work. And we put all of that information out there voluntarily. So in a way, George Orwell was completely correct. I mean, you know, the Big Brother is there, but we are providing that information voluntarily because we want to be out there and we want to interact with other people. And we want to get the feedback about, you know, what food do we like? What movies do we like to watch? So, and that was a real surprise to me that ultimately he is completely correct in this information. We are now being surveyed in a way which was incredible. And I have a friend from East Germany, and she's basically saying, you thought the Stasi was bad? The Stasi was bad? We are being surveyed here in a way that the Stasi could have never achieved, you know. So, and of course, the oppression isn't there, but the surveillance is there. And this is one of the spin-offs, you know, of course.
A little anecdote on that. So when 1984 was actually published, the publisher sent a copy to Aldous Huxley, who was slightly more older than George Orwell. And Huxley read the book and wrote an angry letter to George Orwell saying that my dystopia is better than yours because Brave New World, where people voluntarily give away their information, was more exact. And he wrote a letter.
That's so
this.
Cool. Because we had this as a topic in school. We had to decide which version was more likely, and I went for Huxley as well. You know, so interesting. Well, I didn't know about that letter. That would have got me a much better grade if I'd known.
I do think that earlier to your earlier question, I actually do think that more of a discipline question. I think AI is more of a power problem, and it's definitely one also of collection of resources. So even when people are made aware sometimes of how much data that they are sharing and how much information of their very personal lives are actually out there in big tech is collecting all of this data, they sometimes do respond with, well, I've got nothing to hide. So I don't mind. Mm-hmm. You know, this is helping my life. It's making my life better. And so then, they really don't mind in that sense. And so, you know, my one opinion is that as humans, to some extent, we are but hackable, especially from an HCI perspective. These technologies are designed in a way that make us very happy to continue using it. And we turn off sometimes that critical side for us.
Yeah, that is such a good point. Yeah, exactly.
And I think to build on that, this is the outcome of a long process where now it seems to be a break within two larger periods. So the internet or early AI were predominantly sponsored by DARPA, by military funders, right? And now, you know, they are kind of taken over by big corporates as well as the military. In between, there was a short period of, say, 15 years. In ancient terminology, we call that Web 2.0, when it seemed that the users would take over the means of information circulation. Social media was a cool place to be, you know, fora where you would exchange recipes, parenthood advice, comic book nerdy stuff, and so on. But now all this is being exploited and we are addicted. Relates again to attention spans and human-computer interaction design and so on. So, absolutely.
This conversation has been fascinating to hear all of your perspectives and your research on AI from the different disciplines that you come from and the interdisciplinary approaches that you take. The quick way that we finish each episode is by asking a simple or not so simple question. Do we need disciplines? Sabia?
Simply, yes. However, I think the way that our education system is structured, at least in the majority part all over the world, I think that is outdated. And I think that needs to change. And whether we're talking about this from an interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary or boundary crossing perspective, I think there's value in many of those approaches. But the idea of someone going to school for this many years, you know, sitting in the classroom for this long, being instructed to, being spoken to all the time, I think that we need to really ask some questions there. Is that really the best approach? But yeah, I'm more of the opinion that in the early years, having less structure and later on, once you choose a specialty or you choose a profession, and if you then choose to specialize, I think that would be really useful, because especially for certain fields like medicine and so on, I do think that's important. But we might need something of a bit of a hybrid model, you know, going in the future. So it's sort of a mixture. I think maths is a bit of a mixture.
Monica.
Yeah, I would agree. I think we absolutely need experts, and I think we need AI experts. And I'm saying I'm a user, but I very much rely on these AI experts. You know, the colleagues I'm working with, they are all experts in these foundation models and other models. So I think that's hugely important. But I also agree with Sabir. I think interdisciplinarity is absolutely essential. And to me, it became really clear during the pandemic. I think the pandemic, that was probably the biggest working together of, you know, virologists kind of, you know, developing the vaccine, the clinicians running the clinical trials, you know, saying, okay, it's feasible, it's actually working, public health and psychologists then persuading the public to actually be vaccinated. Because in the beginning, people were saying, I'm not being vaccinated. It normally takes 5 to 10 years to develop a vaccine. No way am I being vaccinated for something which took like, you know, a year. So to kind of do that kind of work, and then obviously to come up with a strategy, like who are the best people to start vaccination on it. And to be honest, I think in the UK that actually worked really, really well. I know there was a lot of criticism, but this idea of starting off with the oldest populations and making them safe, and other countries didn't do that so well. So I totally agree with you. I mean, I think interdisciplinarity is absolutely essential, and I don't really see that there's necessarily a tension. We do need the experts, but the experts need to be open to then really, you know, incorporate other disciplines. You know, that's,
And Vassilis?
Yeah, I totally agree. I only have like literary sprinkles on top of it. I guess poet William Blake asked, why do we see outlines? So we can see of we can think of disciplines as kind of artificial boundaries, right, that they're very social. I adopt a Zen Buddhist approach to it. I believe that disciplines exist and don't exist at the same time. It's a contradiction in terms, but we need to cope with this contradiction. We need to be able to both see what a discipline is, be excited about what we do, know by heart, be disciplined about our field, be excited about it and curious, and at the same time, dismantle them completely. If you see Buddha, kill him. You know, that's the sort of Zen Buddhist approach. If you see the discipline, kill it through your own discipline. There's also, speaking of power, the negative connotation of the word discipline. To be disciplined at your job, is it something you like? No. Disciplinary societies, do we like them? No. A social scientist here at the SGSSS. So I think we need to be aware of both meanings of the term. We need to be disciplined and be proud of our disciplines, but at the same time, expand the frame and see how, from other people's perspectives as well, interview people, be qualitative. Sorry, I have to raise my qualitative sword here. You know, feel them, experience them. And that's probably what AI has to teach us about disciplines, that it's time for better communication, not for walled communication between silos and so on.
Vassilis, Monica, Sabiha, thank you so much for being on this episode of the podcast.
Thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you.
Blessing us.
When Disciplines Meet is hosted by me, Laura Young, recorded at the podcast studio Glasgow and edited by the operations team at the Scottish Graduate School of Social Science. The podcast was conceived by SGSSS's Deputy Director for Training, Dr. Katie Keenan, and Associate Director, Dr. Roxanne Connolly. SGSSS is funded by the Economic and Social Research Council and the Scottish Funding Council and our 16 partner universities. To find out more about the Scottish Graduate School of Social Science, you can visit our website at www.sgsss.ac.uk. Thank you so much for listening.